I really feel passionate about women's empowerment, because I think women have a voice. I just feel like they're not empowered to use their voice. And that's why I like this medium that we're about to have, and this conversation that we're about to have, because I want to empower women to have the conversations that will help other women, you know?
You're speaking my language. I think that's like the inception of even my public Instagram account was, we need to know our bodies. We need to know also what we're experiencing, and that a lot of other women are experiencing it, you know?
So I
feel like knowledge is power. And like you said, women need to know so that they can feel empowered.
I have been looking forward to this conversation for a while, because there's so many things in here that I really want to get into with you. And I'm just so grateful to have you on the show and for you to make the time.
I'm super honored to be on here. I love what you're doing. And so to be a part of this feels, I'm honored as well. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. I think I want to ask you and start off with the first question of, how are you feeling today?
I'm good. I feel like I'm finally in a place of like a chaotic calmness, if that makes sense, right? Like when you have a family and you have kids and you have a career and you have a small business that you're trying to build, everything feels chaotic. And I think I'm finally comfortable in the chaos. And so I feel good.
You mentioned your work. Introduce yourself to everyone and let them know what it is that you do and your background and your experience.
Yeah. So my name is Dr. Prayasi Kothari. I am an ER physician. I am also a certified personal trainer. And most important hat that I wear is, I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I'm a daughter, I'm a sister, I'm a Masi. All of these titles I take very, very seriously. And all of those are really like a part of who I am. So I was born and raised in New York. I did residency in Atlanta, which is what brought me to Georgia. I did residency at Emory and worked in the ER at Great Memorial Hospital, which, for those of you who don't know, is a very community hospital. It serves a lot of the underrepresented communities in our city. And it was such a humbling experience. And oftentimes people ask me why I picked emergency medicine. And I always say that the quick interactions, the quick moments that I get to experience with these patients at their most vulnerable is just so, I felt like I was able to make an impact with even just holding someone's hand, or when you're making a diagnosis. It just felt like I was able to really get connected with someone during their hardest moments. And so it was satisfying. It gives you perspective. And then I ended up staying in Atlanta for when I became an attending, and I met my husband and we settled here. And now I've been an ER physician for over 10 years, which is crazy to me.
So this podcast is called How I Got Through It. And I wanted to ask you if you can share the hardest thing or one of the hardest things that you've been through.
So that's a really loaded question. And I feel like it's very multifaceted. And I think for a lot of us women, there are multiple points that feel like they were really hard. And I would say growing up in New York was an amazing experience. But I think also there was a lot of pressure, a lot of like the rat race. And so sometimes things felt a little out of control. And I did develop an eating disorder when I was in like late high school, early college. And it was a way for me, to feel like I was in control. And after years of like therapy and honestly making the conscious decision when I moved to Atlanta that I was no longer going to engage in those behaviors, my eating disorder, the actions, when you have an eating disorder, whether it's not eating with anorexia nervosa or it's, you know, binging and purging with bulimia, those actions stopped, but the body hate did not stop. And so I developed body dysmorphia, and I will be very honest and say that my body dysmorphia finally, I think, just put to bay when I had my daughter. And when you have a little girl or even a little boy, when you're caring for another human being, and also you realize that you're modeling behavior that they will see, it takes on a whole new perspective. And so the things that I would say out loud, like, I feel so fat, I feel so gross, I stop saying. And I think I hate the term fake it till you make it, but really that's what I was doing. I wasn't allowing those words to come through my lips at all. And slowly, once I stopped saying them out loud, I stopped thinking them. So for me, one of the pivot points in my life was just acknowledging that I had an eating disorder and acknowledging why I had an eating disorder. And that was my way of getting, feeling like I was in control when things around me felt like they were not in my control.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you if you can define what an eating disorder is?
Sure. So an eating disorder is when you either, there's multiple different subsets, right? But the most common ones are commonly known ones are anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa. Then there's binge eating, restrictive eating, or avoidant eating. That's probably the most common. Mm-hmm. I had bulimia, so I would binge and then purge. And it's really hard to talk about because I don't know that I've ever really publicly talked about it like this, but it was really, it started when I realized that I was being told, not by my direct family, but by people in the community, that I looked really healthy. And I didn't think anything of it. I was like, oh, that's, you know, like the Indian term of being healthy. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the best relationship with food when I was growing up. I definitely use it for comfort. I was just eating a lot of junk food. I didn't know what a balanced plate was. I didn't know what good foods, bad foods, or like nutrient dense foods and nutrient like poor foods. I didn't really understand that. And wasn't really taught that, understandably. So I don't think our parents really knew that either. But I remember it started when I was in my high school biology class, and one of my classmates brought like very small amounts of food and said that, you know, and for her, it was like, I can only eat this much. I can only eat this much. And that's when I was like, oh, I should be paying attention to what I'm eating so I don't, you know, look a certain way. And then it devolved into binging and then purging because I felt guilty. Mm-hmm. Or I felt like I was out of control. Mm-hmm. It was, interestingly for me, it was never because my parents made me feel a certain way. It was really what society and what I felt like normal behavior. I thought it was normal to be counting calories at that age. And so that's kind of where it started. And then it progressed in college when I would be under a lot of stress and I would binge and then I would purge, and it became a cycle and it became a coping mechanism. And it wasn't until I was towards the end of college when I started working out that I was able to find a different coping mechanism, which for me was exercise.
Did you at that time, when you're binging or you're purging maybe, let's just take that for example. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that if I'm purging at that time, I would be also shaming myself in my mind thinking negatively towards myself in my mind while I'm throwing something up. What was that like for you?
Yeah, of course. This is the thing with having an eating disorder or even having body dysmorphia. While you're doing it, there's a lot of self-hate that's happening, right? Mm-hmm. Like you are mad at yourself for being in whatever uncontrolled situation it was. Then you're upset at your reaction to that insult. Then you're upset at the reaction to the reaction of that mm-hmm. initial insult when you're never actually dealing with the actual problem. And so, yeah, it was a vicious cycle and there was a lot of shame. And I remember there was a point when my roommate found out and was like, you have to stop or I'm going to tell. And I did stop for a while. Mm-hmm. Because you feel so, I felt dirty. I felt just bad about it. But I will say, as difficult as it was to be in that situation and to feel like it's given me a lot of perspective and insight as I've gotten older. Mm-hmm. I know what it feels like to feel that low. And it's really important for me to never go back to that place.
Mm-hmm. The reason I asked that question too is because when you hear eating disorder, you think, oh, it's this woman's relationship to food or this man's relationship to food, but it's not just that, right? It's like mentally, it's also your relationship to yourself and food as a default. But honestly, when you're trying to get out of that situation, there's so much more self-talk that's involved, so much more of a narrative that's playing in your head. And you're also resisting the temptation of going back to binging and purging, right? Mm-hmm. That's why I asked the question, because I just want people to understand oh, I can stop binging and purging. This is also almost like a battle against yourself, or a battle against old habits that you've been having, and that old way that you used to control your body and your circumstances. I've heard Naomi Wolf, who's an author, she talks about a woman's thinness doesn't have anything to do with her beauty, but it has to do with her obedience. And a lot of times it's obedience to whatever society is impressing on us. And I feel like that is so true for girls that are growing up nowadays. And back then, when you were in high school and college, there wasn't social media. Just imagine now, you know. And exactly. one of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation with you and talk about the myriad of subject matters that also stem from eating disorders is because I did a poll recently, and some people wrote in that they wanted to hear about eating disorders and what someone's experience, because their daughter is experiencing the same thing. And so that's why I'm so grateful that you are able to share and share the inner feelings that you were feeling at the time. I know that you talked about in college when you started to get out of the cycle and your roommate said you have to stop her or she's going to tell. How did you take those first steps?
So I really want to underline that a lot of eating disorders, and of course, everyone's experience is unique, but it isn't about how you look. It's not about the appearance. Mm-hmm. And so when that quote that you just said about obedience and what societal expectations are, it's not necessarily the physical expectation that society has put on you, right? Mm-hmm. It's really what expectations you have put on yourself based on whatever those values are that you're now feeling like you need to be obedient with. Whether for me, it was getting good grades in college or getting good grades in high school, whether it was rejection or it was feeling disappointment, it was a coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, yeah, hearing her tell me that she was going to tell my family, that must have been really hard for her too, right? For my roommate to be like, this is not good. You know, I give her a lot of props for even confronting me, having that conversation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 'Cause it takes courage, you know? And that for me was enough to stop for the time being. But when she was no longer my roommate, that happened again. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't until I sought help with a therapist that I was able to identify that for me, going through transitions was largely anxiety provoking. Mm-hmm. And I was coping with my anxiety by binging and purging. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so for moms that are dealing with this with their children, it's really trying to identify what that insult is that's causing this behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's having an open dialogue and a conversation. It's important to remember that any of us that are going through this already feel a lot of shame. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to feel any more shame. You know, again, empowering them with saying that there's something else that's causing you to do this. What do you think it is? Mm-hmm. Can we backtrack and see when did this start? So it's having an open dialogue that's very empathetic, that's leading with empathy and curiosity as opposed to shame.
And when you're talking to, I see myself in you, and I'm thinking about, even if you're listening to this and you don't have an eating disorder, you don't even know anybody with an eating disorder, I'm thinking about, there are times in my weeks that I think I want to have a slice of pizza. But I'm like, well, do you deserve a slice of pizza this week? Like, did you eat salads every single day and now you can have a slice of pizza? Like, I think in those nuances, those thoughts also are where some of this body dysmorphia comes from. For me, at least, I haven't really even explored it enough, but I'm hearing you talk and I think I kind of think a little bit like that too. Like, it's a, have I earned the slice of pizza because I've been so good this whole week? Does my desire not matter? Am I trying to keep myself in control 5 days a week and then I can give myself a reward? Which there's a healthy way to do that and there's an unhealthy way to do it. But it is kind of interesting as women to how much we think about food and how much we think about control. and how many things we have to keep in control in our life, right? Like, not only do we have to be like intelligent when we're speaking, feeling empowered, looking a certain, like, and these are not by any stretch of the means things that you have to do, but it's all the things that we take in, all the data that we're taking in every single day, mm-hmm. you know, just being out and about.
We're being barraged with, right? Like,
right.
That's what we're seeing. That's what we're seeing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so tell me, now you sought help and you went through that journey. And I know that it's not, oh, I seek help and then I'm on my path to healing and recovery. That's never that. It's never that with anything. It's always you seek help, you start, and then you two steps back, and then you three steps forward, two steps back, that kind of thing. And I completely understand that. Can you explain to me what that experience was like for you?
So I think you're right. Everyone's healing path is different. Mm-hmm. My personality is as such that once I'm done, my husband hates when I say I'm done. Once I'm done, I'm done. Like I can't move back. And so for me, it was very much a fresh start. When I moved to Atlanta, it was a fresh start. It was a very conscious decision I made in my very first apartment that was, I am not binging and purging in this apartment. It is not happening. And were there times I really, really wanted to? Yeah, residency was hard as F. Like, it was hard. But I found other ways to cope with the difficulties. Mm-hmm. I took up kickboxing, and that was my outlet. And it was movement. I was getting movement in. I was in with a community of other individuals. I was able to separate my work life from my workout life, from my home life. And it was very much a conscious decision. With that being said, that was when I finally stopped. The journey to getting there was a lot of, I'm not going to do it in medical school. I'm a physician in training. I know better. And so then you would stop. Mm-hmm. Or, oh my God, I'm getting migraines now. Is it because of what I've been doing? So I would stop. But yes, it was a two step forward, three step back, three steps forward, one step back. Like, it was definitely an up and down journey. And I think it was, again, like the fresh start, there's this thing called the fresh start effect. It was definitely a fresh start that made me say, okay, I'm not going to do it. And I will say this, every time an insult happened where I would feel the urge to go and binge and purge, I would coach myself out of it, do something different. And then the subsequent time, if I had that same urge, I would rely on the fact that I didn't do it the last time. Mm-hmm. And I was able to stack up more times of not binging and purging that really, I built up that muscle, built up that habit, that coping mechanism instead.
Mm-hmm. And now it's compounded over time. How mm-hmm. long has it been now since that?
Over 13 years.
Yeah. Isn't that incredible?
Incredible. Like, incredible. And I'm not going to lie, and I'm being so transparent now, but it doesn't sound like it never goes away completely, but you know, you really do remember why you stopped. Mm-hmm. And I recently stopped drinking as well about a year ago. Mm-hmm. And every time I'm like in a situation, I'm like, oh, I would like to have a drink. And I never had an issue with alcohol. But I just don't enjoy the taste. So I'm like, why am I doing this? When you're in social situations and social settings, people are going to offer it to you. And it was the habit of saying no and no and no that it became, now I just say to people, I don't drink. Mm-hmm. So there's no questions, you know? And so it's, again, it's building that habit of saying no, or building a habit of relying on your other coping mechanisms.
Yeah. I think you're also designing the life that you really want, right? I think your life is a lot more coming from the inside out internally, and you're creating this external world for yourself where you're like, like, even everyone goes out Friday night and drinks, and it's like, you know, why am I even doing this? I'm happy to go out and have a good time, but I just don't really feel like I need this alcohol, waking up hungover the next day, all that stuff. And and so you're really consulting yourself. You're really harnessing your own voice too. And you're really like in that empowering kind of phase of your life, which is why I understand that if I ask you, how are you feeling? You're feeling great in the chaos, probably, you know?
Yes. Cause you know, it's leading an intentional life, right? Mm-hmm. We as women, professionals, busy individuals are just oftentimes trying to stay afloat and just doing the path of least resistance. And we're not really engaging in that decision-making. Mm-hmm. So this is me reclaiming what I want to and what I can. There are so many things, i.e. my car yesterday being broken. Like, there are so many things that are out of our control. Yeah. But how do we flip the narrative so we can feel like we are empowered still in this state of chaos? You know, although the eating disorder was like, I left it behind in New York, the body dysmorphia still reared its ugly head.
Explain to me what body dysmorphia is. I'm asking you these questions. I know you're a doctor. You can also like give us the science also behind it and the medical reasons maybe behind it.
Body dysmorphia is really your perception of how you look. It's all a perception. But what it means to me, or what it looks like to me, is body hate. Not appreciating what my body is doing, not appreciating what my body looks like. It's the aesthetic thing, but it's also the internal and the why isn't my body doing this? And for me, it really was at a pinnacle during when I was diagnosed with infertility. Why can my body not do what it was biologically created to do? And so I didn't do the binging and purging because I had left that, but I did a lot of self-hate. There was a lot of self-hate, and it took me a long time to get to a place where I could appreciate what my body was able to do.
That's kind of interesting and difficult, because you're having body dysmorphia, not because of something you see, but because of the way that your body is working at that time. I would imagine when you're thinking through that whole situation, the shame from the eating disorder days comes back.
Oh my God, yes.
The internal negative self-talk comes back. Can you talk to me about like what that conversation was like with your doctor? What did you hear?
Yeah.
And how that all unfolded for you?
So just a little bit about infertility. 1 in 8 women will experience some version of infertility mm-hmm. in their life. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was 33 and my husband and I were trying to get pregnant for 6 months. And as a physician, I knew what I needed to do, like ovulation kits and all that stuff that you're supposed to do, you know, timed intercourse, all of it. Stillborn pregnant after 6 months. And I just had a women's intuition or a spidey sense that something just felt like I couldn't wait. So the recommendations are, if before the age of 35, you try for 1 full year and then you seek help from the reproductive the REI doc.
Yeah.
So when with me, I was like 6 months, she says, this doesn't feel right. So I went to see my OB. She did some blood tests and she's like, your hormone levels are, they're all within normal, but they're at the lower limit or the upper limit. So she's like, if you want to, you can go see a specialist. So I went and did, I went ahead and made an appointment. And when I got my labs back and they did an ultrasound, they're like, yeah, your eggs or ovaries are definitely older than what your stated age is. So she's like, I think for you, we would go ahead and try to do intrauterine insemination. And then if that doesn't work after 3 rounds, we'll go ahead and do, you know, IVF, in vitro fertilization. And I had the biggest like gut punch. I was like, why is this so hard? Like, I had that spidey sense, but I didn't want to believe that it was going to actually come to this. Mm-hmm. I thought that if I did all the hard work, like I've done my whole life, if I do all the things, it'll happen. And this was the one thing where you can't, no amount of effort you put in is going to give you the result you desire.
Yeah.
It's not a guarantee. And so we did IUI 2 times because I recognized for me emotionally doing it a 3rd time was taking more toll on me. So we went to IVF, and after a couple of rounds, we were able to successfully get pregnant with our daughter. Mm-hmm.
How did your relationship with yourself and your body at that time change through this process?
There was a lot of frustration, a lot of like, why can't you do this? Like, what's wrong with you? It was a dark time for me. I really secluded myself from my friends, you know, my family. I was in a negative headspace and I thought it was my fault. I was like, I've worked out too much. I've worked out too much. This is why I'm not getting pregnant. That's what my mom was saying. You worked out too much, like stop working out. And so I did. I stopped working out, which for me, I learned through the years, was my coping mechanism. And my movement for me is very meditative. Mm-hmm. I am able to really get my thoughts out, like listen to my thoughts. And so taking that away was a double insult. And I really had to crawl myself out of this hole. What I conscientiously was like, I'm going to be a mom. I just don't know how.
Yeah.
Is it going to be through adoption? Is it going to be through embryo donation? Is it going to be through IVF? I don't know. But I knew that I wanted to be a mom. And I did. So I think we all have our preconceived notions of how we want, how motherhood should look like, mm-hmm. and how your journey to motherhood should look like. But it was me finally being like, motherhood is what I want. How I get there, the road, the path that leads to that is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just remember, I also am working in the ER, where you oftentimes you're delivering news to people that, oh, you're pregnant, and they have no desire for that pregnancy.
Yeah.
So it was emotionally, I was getting confronted with this every day. And so at some point I was like, I can't expect to just feel better. It's not going to just happen. Mm-hmm. I have to actively work on my reactions. And what can I do to make myself, how can I get myself out of this? No one's going to pull you out.
Yeah.
As much as your spouse loves you and your friends, even your friends who are going through it, love you and understand, it really was self-determination to be like, I have to figure out what I need to do.
Yeah. I think the other layer too is being an Indian woman, which we haven't talked about, but there's such an importance placed on a woman bringing children into this world. Mm-hmm. And that being the third metric, right? Have a great education, get married, have kids, and then be on your merry way, like have a great life. And I think that is a pressure that I don't even know how I would deal with if I was faced with the news that you were faced with. Did you have to deal with any of that?
I was really lucky. My parents and my in-laws were not like that. They were so supportive the whole time. And I will say this, my mom was really, she's always been a tough mom. I love her. She like pushed me so hard. I don't know that I would be a physician if it weren't for her like pushing me up the hill through medical school or to get into med school. She really drove that home. And she has always inspired me and with her home work ethic. But when I was going through IVF and she came and stayed with me, we had just bought our house. She was like, I could see how proud of me she was that I was taking these shots every day, that it didn't bother me. I mean, when I was a kid, I would be in tears over a blood draw. And so the idea of me now doing my own injections every day, getting blood draws every day, getting ultrasounds done every day, just, she was so, so proud of me. And she's like, you were so strong.
That's so incredible to have that support, especially during a time like that, where you're wondering about your own body and you're trying to figure it all out in your head. And you don't need this external pressure from the outside.
Yeah.
What do you think you learned through that, going through not only the eating disorder, but specifically body dysmorphia and this infertility journey? What did you learn through this experience?
I'm really lucky that I was able to get pregnant through IVF. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of my, I'll sort of backtrack, right before our second transfer with that yielded our pregnancy, our daughter. I was in New York for a wedding in Jersey at the Hyatt. And I remember going for a run that day. And that's when it dawned on me that my body has been doing some incredible things just through infertility treatments. You are injecting your body with so many hormones. Mm-hmm. You're expecting your ovaries to produce these eggs that are in a way that is not like biologically, it's that way, it's not physiologically normal, mm-hmm. but yet my body was still responding. Mm-hmm. I remember just being like, taking a breath of fresh air. I'm like, I need to be so grateful for this body that I'm in right now. Mm-hmm. And that for me was like the turning point. And I was just like, F it, I'm going to work out. I'm going to just appreciate what I can do. And we're going to see how this next transfer goes.
Yeah.
It was just appreciating. It was practicing gratitude for what I did have.
Yeah. I think that also connects you to not only your body, but the present moment and just the grasp of the thing that you want so badly. I think that when you start having gratitude, it just kind of loosens the grasp a little bit and you can like breathe. And this thing can also breathe that you were holding on to, because I feel like everything has its own pulse. That can also breathe a little bit. And I think that maybe sometimes in that space is where things manifest for you in your life, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know, but like my spidey senses tell me that that's probably what happened for you as well. Yeah. And everyone's journey is different and how you come to gratitude and being connected and being present in your own life. But maybe that was the path that you also had to take to finally like sit in the moment, this moment with yourself, because you've been through a lot, like, you know, the days of binging and purging and medical school alone is a lot.
Medical school is a culture of binging and purging. I always say this all the time. Like, we binge study.
Yes.
We binge party.
Yes.
You know, like there's no chill. You're not just even keeled in med school. It's very much high intensity. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely. It's been tough. You know, it was tough, but it was also like my defining moment.
Yeah. And how has being a mother changed you?
God, in every way possible. And it really forced me to look at myself in the mirror and really appreciate everything that I have been able to do, but also recognize where I needed improvement. Mm-hmm. And my why for a lot of what I do is I want to be a role model for my kids, for my two girls. I went through IVF with my older one and we had her. It was like amazing. She was amazing. And then COVID hit right before we were supposed to go through IVF again. And after I had my daughter, I learned more about how common infertility was amongst Indian women. Mm-hmm. And it just was so disheartening that when I was going through this, I felt so alone. I felt so isolated.
Yeah.
And I think when I realized that so many more women were experiencing this, I wanted to put myself out there so that other women knew that they weren't alone. And so I, in real time, documented my infertility journey on my social media page. Mm-hmm. The highs of getting an embryo, the lows of only getting one embryo, and then finally announcing my pregnancy. I wanted it to be as authentic and genuine, because there's emotions in that, right? Like the disappointment you get after you have been injecting yourself with hormones for 12 days and you only end up getting one embryo. That's really hard. Mm-hmm. But it also has served as strength for putting myself out there and really speaking my truth. Mm-hmm. For as proud of my mom was about going through infertility treatments, the strength that I exhibited during the whole process, mm-hmm. she was like, take that page down. No one needs to know. Because friends of friends or friends of family would see my Instagram and they'd be like, oh my God, auntie, I had no idea she was going through this. My mom was like, why do they know? Why does the world need to know? And I was like, it's not that they need to know. I want other women to not feel alone. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I think that's a difference with our mother's generation and our generation, right? It's kind of like, yes, they want you to be strong, but they also don't want anyone to know what you're being strong about. Or the other thought is, what will these people say? Like, that's always in their brains, right? And then we're kind of like, oh, we went through this hard thing. I want to share it. I built a whole show because of it. You're in real time documenting your infertility journey. And I can get how that would seem shameful to our parents and to our mothers specifically. But I think that it is the brave thing to do, because it lends a story of we are more alike than we are different, right?
Yes.
And I love the idea that you're creating something that you wish you had for yourself when you were going through that journey. I think that that is so incredibly valuable to the world, because I often think about, because I'm in my mid-30s and I think about when I'm ready to get pregnant, I wonder if it's going to happen for me, because I talk about this with my friends all the time, and I'm glad that there are resources like your mm-hmm. page. Where can people find you online? And also tell us a little bit about your coaching and what you're doing with that and how you're helping other women.
Sure, absolutely. So you can find me online. My website will be launching in hopefully about a month. But right now my handle is PreysMD, PreysMD. Mm-hmm. And I started, so I will, through the whole infertility journey and learning to like love movement, as movement is medicine, movement is meditative. Mm-hmm. After I had my second daughter, my first pregnancy was fine. I ended up with gestational diabetes with both of them. And for me, that was another like, you know, punch in the stomach. I'm like, I'm so healthy. Like yeah. I work out all the time. How did I end up with gestational diabetes? And my dad has diabetes. We have a very strong family history of diabetes. And also, we're also South Asian. So we're already predisposed to it. After I had my first, I was like back in the gym, working out, exercising, all that good stuff. After my second, my postpartum anxiety was really high. I had a traumatic delivery with my first that I don't think I fully actually dealt with until closer to my second pregnancy's delivery. And so I had anxiety with COVID, and then I had anxiety during the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, I had a little bit of postpartum anxiety. I really lost myself after my second daughter. Her personality, she's a spitfire, she's a firecracker, and she knew what she wanted from the moment she entered this world. I just didn't know her cues. I didn't know her yet. I was still getting to know her. And so about 6 months postpartum, I really took exercise and fitness and movement. I took it really seriously because that for me was my time for myself to refine myself. I was consuming content via books and podcasts that was really empowering. And I reclaimed who I was in all of this. And I'll say this, I think a lot of time in our life as women professionals in general, like our 20s are dedicated to finding and developing our career professionally, right? Mm-hmm. Our 30s are dedicated to family building and finding your spouse. And I think as we sort of check those marks off, similar to what you said earlier, when you're like, you get married, you have a kid, and then like that's what the societal expectations are. You buy your house, then it's like go live your merry life. But what does that look like to you? And yeah. For me, I was like, what does that look like for me? I love emergency medicine, but am I in love with it as much as I was when I first started? Mm-hmm. And I love movement, and I want women, especially Indian women who don't know how to strength train, who don't know the metabolic implications of strength training, who don't know how to even start. That is where I was like, I want to teach them. I want to show them. I want to spread that. Mm-hmm. And that's where my coaching started. Or that's how I came to coaching.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I've seen your page and I've seen your posts, and they are so inspirational. Also, while giving you good information about our own bodies, which I think is so, you're right. And I think now fitness has become something that's talked about a lot more in the Indian culture, but 10 years ago, not so much, you know?
I agree. You know, I think as Indians, we're predisposed to diabetes, hypertension, all these chronic medical conditions. There's a lot that we can do to prevent it. Mm-hmm. We just don't know. I think we are the generation of consuming a lot of content and knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I think we're also ready to implement and execute. Mm-hmm. We just need a roadmap.
Yeah.
Right. So if I can tell you, people will think that, hey, I want a six pack, so I'm going to go work out. That's a great why. If that's someone's why, by all means, let that be your why. Whatever's going to motivate you to get to the gym, that's great. Mm-hmm. But I think for a lot of people, it's more like, I want to run with my kids. I want to have energy. So I want to be able to go hike up in Banff without having to train to hike up in Banff. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's leading an active lifestyle daily that I really want people to be able to do. And nothing needs to be excessive. There's this misconception that you have to work out 5 times a week and you have to be pouring sweat.
Yeah.
Like we learned, anything with intensity is not sustainable.
Yeah.
So it's just small movement throughout the week that will, you know, keep you healthy and active.
Yeah. I think it's incredible listening to your story, to where you came from and now where you are, and how you're using that experience that you went through to now help other women. I think it's so incredibly commendable.
You know, the biggest thing I say, or I really believe, is your hardest moments are really hard, but that's also where your strength comes in. That's also where you find yourself. every single hard thing you've been through, you've overcome. There's no way to get through something. You can't go around it. You just have to get through it. Mm-hmm. And just constantly remembering all the adversity you've overcome will provide strength for the adversity that you are facing or that you will face. Mm-hmm. You can do hard things.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you can do hard things really well.
Yes. I think about Winston Churchill has this quote. He says, if you're going through hell, just keep going, you know?
Yes. Keep going. Yes. Don't stop there.
Yeah. You don't want to live there.
Yes. Exactly.
Just keep going.
Exactly.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your story. And I don't take it lightly. I mean, a lot of things that you shared are, I'm sure, was incredibly, just even going back to those places mentally, right? Like, and remembering what that girl was like that was in college or in high school. You know, I know that's not easy. And I'm so grateful and so thankful that you were, that you trusted me to share that with me and share that with everyone. And I think, like I said, it's so commendable that you have now designed your life, right? Like you have,
yeah.
Now I don't want to say do a 180 because life is so fluid and it's ever moving, but you have gotten closer to the life that you desire to live every single day. And you're making choices every single day to get closer to that. And I think that is the thing that's commendable. And I'm just so grateful and thankful that you were able to come on today.
I'm so grateful too. And I think it's also really important for us as women and anyone going through a hard moment, when you look back and see where your life is 5 years from now, mm-hmm. it's also really important to at this moment where I am today, I'm so grateful to that girl mm-hmm. who was 18 years old, who like struggled through it, because I wouldn't be where I am today had I not had that. Mm-hmm. And the shame that I felt also allowed me to feel the pride that I feel right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we got to be thankful for all of the adversity we've been through, because it's what shaped us to who we are today. So.
Yeah.
Thank you again for letting me share my story and just to have this conversation.
Yeah, I'm happy to do it. I'm happy to have you on. I really, really enjoyed this episode with you. So thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes. And I look forward to having coffee with you in Atlanta.
Yes. Yes. We'll make it happen.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye. Take care.